Okay, we're recording. Well, good morning. My name is Michelle Place. I'm the Executive Director for the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum. I have with me Mr. Robert Howard Patty, and today we're going to talk about some really difficult a time in our city. So, Mr. Patty,
yes,
do I call you Robert or
yes, ma'am.
Bob?
Call me Bob.
Okay, I'm going to call you Bob. So we want to make sure that your microphone is working. So if you can, why don't you give your full name and...
My name is Robert Howard Patty. I'm a Seminole Irish man, and I was born on September 23rd, 1948.
Keep going.
All right. We're here to discuss what I have seen years ago as a police officer in the city of Tulsa. On the anniversary of the race riot in 1973, we were sitting, along with my supervisor, there were several of us there, sitting in the police lounge discussing the riot. And comments were made, I heard so-and-so and I heard such-and-such, and we heard this was so much and this was so bad. And my supervisor said, boys, tell you what, if you can keep your mouth shut, I'll take you and show you just how bad it was. So we followed him, and we went down the hallway. We were in the lounge of the police station. And we were taken to the archives room, which is on the, it's actually on the east side of the police station, on the south, or on the north wall. As you walk in, you see a corner there. You can either turn and go left to booking, or you can go straight. Well, that corner right there is the corner of this room that I'm talking about. And we were taken there, and it was filled with metal racks that were stacked full of file boxes. Boxes that contained legal files from the records division, case files, closed cases, stuff that wasn't working anymore that they didn't have room for in records. Well, we were taken there, and there was a table there, and we sat around the table. And Wayburn Cotton was a gentleman's name. He's dead now. I can talk about him. He took a box off the shelf and set it on the table, and the box contained legal envelopes, the type that you twist string around to hold together, and he dumped out pictures on the table. And we were passing these pictures around and looking at them. And my life will never be the same. And I'm a combat veteran. Horribly graphic pictures. And these pictures that we were looking at, people kept exclaiming, God, I hope he was dead. And these are cops. These are combat veterans, some of them. And in the end, we were almost finished, and he said, well, boys, we better start winding this up.
Hang on. About how many photographs do you think that there were? Are we talking 5, 50?
In the entire box, there were probably less than 500.
Less than 500. Mercy. Okay.
They were all of the pictures that had been taken officially and all of the pictures that had been confiscated from the newspapers and just people walking around with a camera. All the people lost their cameras. All the pictures got confiscated from the papers. And
what do you mean that the cameras got taken away? Like, police officers
would snatch people with cameras.
Okay.
Federal marshals were there in Tulsa at the time.
Okay.
And they grabbed anybody taking pictures. And I don't blame them. But at any rate, my supervisor got a call on his walkie-talkie, and he left the room to talk in the hallway. And I started to put some pictures back in the box, and I saw another folder in the bottom of the box. I got it out, opened it up, poured the pictures out. And they were pictures of a bulldozer and trucks and a ditch and trucks with white bags and brown bags and bloody looking bags in the back of this truck. And there were probably between 24 and 32 pictures in this folder. And I was looking them over, and there were convicts with wheelbarrows shoveling white powder into this ditch that had been dug with a bulldozer. And there were three trucks in this picture. And I knew exactly where it was. It was in my district. And I had chased people through that area many times. And I knew exactly where it was. The topography did not change. This was 50 years later. But the landscape was still there. The road was still there. Mm-hmm. Still in the form that it was at that time. Mm-hmm. And
the location is?
And the location is at 8th and Maybell Avenue.
Okay.
Maybell runs south from 3rd Street to 8th, and then it curved west because of the topography of the land. There was a drop-off, maybe 15, 20 feet there. Mm-hmm. So they made the road curve, and it came out down 25th West Avenue. Mm-hmm. And it actually come around another curve and then went back and zigzagged down to 25th West Avenue. Well, when my supervisor came back in the room and he started putting stuff back in it, and when he looked and the box was empty, and he looked over what I've got and he hollered, "Get out of here. Let's go. This is over." So the guy got up and left, and he got up in my face and he said, "You weren't supposed to look at those." I said, "I'm sorry, Cotton." I thought they were in the bottom of the box. We were looking at the picture. I said, I just got them out, pulled them out, and looked at them, man. I said, "I know you guys probably, but I'm sorry." And he said, "You know what that is, don't you?" And I said, "Well, it looks like it. They're burying people in a ditch." And he said, "That's the best kept secret in Tulsa, Oklahoma." He said, "Son, if you mention a word of this to anybody, they'll kill you and they'll kill me for showing it to you." And I said, "Damn, God." And he said, you know where this is, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, it's 8th and Maybell." He said, "God damn it, don't you ever let them words out of your mouth long as I'm alive. All right?" And I stuck my hand out and we shook on it with an FOP shake.
Okay.
And that's the blood oath. And I did not mention any of that until I had heard that Wayburn Cotton had died. And this was around 2001.
Okay. And just for the record, can you describe the relationship that you and Wayburn Cotton had?
Father and son.
Okay.
I would have had him for my father. I lost my dad when I was 12. Mm-hmm.
And so...
He was my father figure.
Yeah.
He was my mentor, my confidant, my protector. Mm-hmm. I was a wild child, and he kept me out of trouble.
Lovely.
But he respected me for my ability, and I respected him simply for the person he was.
So what was his role in the police department that he would have had access or know about these photographs?
Been there since dirt.
Been there since dirt, okay.
And I guess that was the only job he'd had. I don't know. But he was so good at what he did and so good with people. There wasn't an officer that did not love that man.
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm trying to understand is, who would have had access to these photographs? Did he have a particular...
He had keys to the entire police department.
Okay.
And he knew what had went on there for years.
Okay. Which is not something that everyone would have had access to.
No.
That's where...
I imagine it was a very limited access to this room. But being a night supervisor, he had all the keys to everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he had a master key, and he could open any door mm-hmm. in the police station. Mm-hmm. And he and I spoke about this several times. We rode together for a couple of nights after that. And he gave me the whole story behind it. And I'll begin with it.
Okay.
Before
we get there, do you think those photographs still exist?
I would say it would be human nature against the odds of anybody throwing these pictures away.
Okay.
They are so morbid that they appeal to the evil in folks.
Okay.
I hope they have been destroyed.
Because
I do.
They're so
because
graphic.
Nobody needs to see these pictures.
Okay.
And I am very hesitant to get totally involved in describing these pictures. But
we talked about that, the fact that you did not, in this recording, you did not really want to talk about how horrible, how graphic. I don't want to put words in your mouth at all, but that you did not want to talk about the photo.
I would just simply think it would be counterproductive. At that moment in time, the gates of hell had swung wide open, mm-hmm. and the devil was dancing in the streets. And Tulsa police officers were standing by watching. That's what bothered me.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
Can you imagine?
No.
You don't want to imagine,
yeah.
do you? These pictures depict the physical acts of man's inhumanity to man, which has no bounds. But at any rate, the story that I was told from Wayman Cotton was on the 4th of June, and it's summertime, and there's no air conditioning in 1921. I assume you know what a body looks like after 4 days in the sunshine. That's what they were dealing with. And they were constantly, several times a day, going back and forth between New Block Park, where all these bodies and body parts had been collected. They'd been driving north up to 3rd and Denver to the ice house that was on the corner of 3rd and Denver that serviced the Frisco Railroad. And they would get truckloads of ice and take them back to New Block Park and dump them on the body parts to keep them from smelling so bad. Well, things were getting out of hand, and they had to do something, and people were watching them real close. So the marshals were called in, and they scooted everybody back to 33rd West Avenue until 11th and Denver. They had the whole area blocked off, north, south, and they loaded. The reason they found this place, they were driving back and forth from 3rd and Denver to New Block Park with this ice, and at the curve of 9th, or at 8th and Maybell, one of the employees said, if they're looking for a place to bury them folks, won't we do it right here? The city owns this property right here. We could bury them right here. Yeah, let's do. So arrangements were made that morning, and they took a bulldozer, and right on the curb of 8th and Maybell, they dug a trench running from the northeast to the southwest, diagonal across this curve of the road. And the ditch was probably, let's see, a roadway is 22 feet, so that's 11 feet to the edge of the road from the center line. And the grade below the road was such that they had to dig the ditch about 5, maybe 6 steps from the edge of the road to keep it from caving into the ditch. And it looks like they dug the ditch about 20 feet deep with the bulldozer. And the pictures that I observed were taken from a boxcar, atop of a boxcar that was sitting on the railroad track, where they could look west at the gravesite, which is, and 9th and 8th and Maybell was right on the curb where the railroad track went around to go to Sand Springs. Well, they dug this ditch.
Okay, let's talk about this photographer on top of the boxcar. Do you think he was unobserved, that people just...
I think he was an official.
You think he was official?
Because he had taken pictures of one dozen. There were 12 of them, U.S. Marshals, standing in a group picture with their arms.
Ah, posed.
Posed, yeah, at the site. And in other pictures, you would see these people on boxcars standing up on the road by the truck or down by the ditch. And one was talking to the bulldozer driver on the other side of the pile of dirt. And they were moving around, and they had the area secured. And I would guess that nobody could have slept in there other than an official photographer and taken these pictures. Mm-hmm. Not that many of them, not from the same spot.
Okay. So I was just curious.
It had to have been an official photographer that photographed this gravesite.
Okay. So I interrupted you on the story.
Well, at any rate, these trustees, as they were unloading these trucks, were shoveling quicklime onto the bodies. And I don't know where they got the quicklime. You can drive up along the railroad track, so they probably pulled a truck up there and had these guys. They were convicts. They had striped pants on. And most of them were black. And they were unloading the body parts out of the truck, tumbling them down the hill and into the grave. And as they were doing that, these guys would shovel quicklime on. And that's how we're going to find the grave. You can use a pH probe that will tell the difference in the pH of different soils, and contractors use it to find the level of a grade of fill. No two types of dirt have the same pH content. So they can push this probe down and tell where one dirt stops and another starts to find how much fill is there or how much they need to put there or whatever. But they can. That's a cheap, easy way to to find his grave. You can push that rod into the ground, and when you hit 10 and 11 on pH, you're in the middle of that grave. Now, the after the grave was filled, the dozer pushed the dirt back over it, and they had a couple of pictures of him doing that. And then he pulled it all sideways and smoothed it out. But the people that were in this grave, I'm going to say between 100 and 120 people, because it was three army trucks with sideboards that had probably at least 4 feet of bodies in them, in each of them. And I'm going to say each truck probably held between 25 and 40 bodies. Many of them were in pillowcases, wrapped up in sheets, and some were just clothed or unclothed. Their injuries were very apparent. It's indescribable. I can describe it, and I can give you graphic details, but it's before lunch, if you get my drift.
Yeah.
Weyburn and I, sat and talked about the deal, and he said, the fact that you've seen the pictures of the goings-on during the riot in this gravesite, he said, you need to keep your mouth shut. He said, this is not something anybody wants to know. And he said, if this grave is located and exhumed, he said, people will realize how these folks died. And he said, if you think race relations are bad right now, he said, we've been 50 years quieting this down. He said, if this gets out, he said, we'll have hell all over again. And that has been a fulcrum on my soul. I have pivoted one way or the other.
I was going to ask if you had, if you wanted to talk about, do you think that was the right thing to do? Have we...
The overbearing thing that always surfaces is the fact that these people deserve a decent burial. And that has driven me. I stayed quiet for so long, and it ate on me. And that's why I'm near the end of my life. I'm becoming more and more passionate about getting these people a decent burial. They didn't deserve what happened to them. They didn't deserve being buried under a damn railroad track. And they've been there for 98 and a half years. I'd like to see it, this mass grave, exhumed and reinterred somewhere decent. And these people need a Christian burial. And I'm not a Christian. But I sympathize, and I'll do anything I can to right this wrong. I feel it's a wrong.
Is it surprising to you, with obviously there were other people there, I mean, whether the conflicts or the convicts or the marshals or whatever, that people did not talk about it, or, you know, that word did not leak out of what had happened? Is that surprising to you? Am I from a different era and I just don't understand that?
Well, there is a brotherhood between police officers. And you can do by, just like me, like giving this information, I can do as much harm as I can good. And that's a struggle for me. But there again, the overriding decision I make is I've got to get these people properly buried. And that's what drives me. That's what I'm about.
Okay. So can we discuss the times that you have talked before? I mean, I know that you had spoken with Randy Crable before, and also Dick Warner. So let's talk about how those conversations went. Were you able to say everything that you wanted to say? Not with those two. Okay,
I didn't have the time. I really didn't have the time then.
What do you mean you didn't have the time to?
Well, we were only together. We were together less than an hour.
Okay.
I spent more time with you than I did with the two of them.
Okay. Do you sense that they were not willing to listen, or were you holding back certain facts because of your promise to Officer Cotton?
Both.
Okay, can you talk a little more about that?
Well, originally when I met him there at 3rd and Denver, and we were driving.
Okay, who's we?
Me and this started when I heard Wayburn Cotton had died.
Okay.
Then I started, subconsciously, I guess.
Okay.
I thought, Wayburn's dead. Wayburn's dead. I can help these people. And then, right after I heard Wayburn passed away, Randy Crable put a article in the Tribune about the race riot.
Yeah, okay, he works for the Tulsa World, so...
Oh, the World,
point of clarification.
Back then
no
we
problem.
Had a World and
yeah,
a Tribune.
Yeah,
there.
No problem.
Anyway, and I called the paper.
Okay.
And I said, Mr. Crable, my name's Bob Patty. I used to be a police officer here in town. I know where the mass grave is from the 1921 race riot. I know exactly where it is. I can take you and show you. Can you? Yes, sir. Would you mind if I bring someone with me? Not at all. And he brought a man named Dick Warner, who was a city historian, I believe, did he work here?
Well, he was a volunteer for the Tulsa Historical Society and served on the state commissioned...
Historical commission?
Yes. Well, on the race riot commission that the governor had appointed at the time, and then that report was released in 2001. So he did not officially work for the Tulsa Historical Society, but I did know him very well. And
can we take a dido right here just for a moment?
Sure.
I have two books you might be interested in.
Okay.
They were privately done about the history of Oklahoma, recorded officially, government documents. I have both volumes of the history of Oklahoma statewide in my library, if you'd like to have them. They are large, and they include all of the legal goings-on at the time of Oklahoma statehood, and I'll bring them to you. I'll give them to you when you take me home.
Okay.
Yeah. They're very expensive, but I'd love to donate them.
Thank
because
you.
I think you can do more good with them than I could.
Thank you.
And I've read them.
Okay.
But
so,
anyway.
Okay, so we're back to Randy Crable ask you if he may bring Dick Warner to you.
And,
so you
I said certainly.
And you all meet at 3rd and Denver?
And we made... made a date to meet at 3rd and Denver on a given day, and I parked my truck there at 3rd and Denver and got in the car with him, and And that started the conversation, and I just said, you know, Ice House and New Rock Park, Brighton Board and Bed, hey, won't we bury him here? And on and on. And Randy was kind of interested in the other pictures, but I was conversing mostly with Dick Warner on a location. And when we got out there, he got out maps and legal descriptions and this and that, and had them on the handrail. And he said, my God, this has got to be it. The city owned this property in 1921. I said, I'm carrying them to you, they're down there. I said, they dug the ditch right there. They threw the body parts down this hill, tumbled them in the ditch, covered them with lime, put the sand back over them. And that was about the extent of our visit. And Randy was talking to me a little bit about the other pictures, and I said, oh, they're horrible. You know. If you're going to eat tonight, you probably don't want me going into that, you know. I said, well, I'll be glad to. And he said, well, maybe one of these days we can sit down and talk about that. And I said, I'll be glad to. And I said, plan on getting upset.
Yeah. And so
but
you...
I did not discuss that much about the other pictures with Dick Warner.
Okay.
And that may be where Betsy is saying that my stories have changed over the years. But I spent three times as much time with you so far as I did with Dick back then.
Okay. And the same is true of Randy Crable, that you really haven't spoken to Randy until day before yesterday?
Yeah,
after you and I talked.
Yeah.
Okay, then you called
Randy.
I just called him to
kind of touch base with him and see what he knew about what had occurred in the interim.
Yeah. Well, and I had spoken to... Randy also, after we had talked, and said, and when I mentioned your name, he immediately clued back. I'm always amazed at Randy's memory and recall and what he can immediately call to. So, I know, or you and I discussed that you've had threats against your life, being
That's
shot, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you
This started... back when I first got a hold of Dick Warner and Randy Creep. It wasn't long after that.
Do we know approximately what year?
2001.
2001, okay.
I believe it's when Randy put the article in the paper.
Okay.
It was 2000 or 2001?
I bet it was 2000, but go ahead.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where was I?
The article in the paper about call, and so you...
I just called him, and I said, I've been sitting on something for years. I promised a man I wouldn't say a word about it as long as he was alive, and he's no longer alive, and I'd like to get this off my chest.
Okay.
I'd like somebody to know about this, because I want to get these people a decent grave.
Okay.
And that was, you know, I didn't spend a whole lot of time with them.
Okay.
I took them there, and when Dick Warner said, this has got to be it. This has got to be it. The city owned this property at that time. And he said, and it all fits. He said, this fits with everything that I have ever heard.
And so,
I told him about the marshals, you know, moving people back.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, people were looking. They were waiting for them to leave to go to the country with these bodies. And they never did. And I said, yeah. And when they went back and forth with these trucks to the ice house, I said, they pulled in with a fake load. And they loaded the bodies, and they left back towards the ice house. And that's how the bodies disappeared. This has got to be it. I said, I'll go and goddamn tell you it's it. I said, I've seen the pictures. They dug the ditch. They pushed the dirt this way. And then they covered it back up this way. And I told him, I said, if you want to find just exactly where it is, I'll walk out there and stand in the middle of it. He said, no. He said, I got it down. I drove him a map there on driving up there and showed him where the ditch had been dug. And I said, there's the ditch right there. I said, right where the ground levels out towards the grade there. I said, within maybe 10 paces of the edge of the road is the edge of that ditch. And then the ditch is 12 feet wide. So 16 feet from the edge of the road, center of the ditch.
Okay.
And I said, you can add 11 feet to that from the center line of the road.
And I want to be careful about not putting words in your mouth here. So once you had that conversation and the site visit, if you will.
And what we did?
The site that you went out to, 8th and Maybell, and had that conversation with Randy Crable and Dick Warner, did you feel that you had turned the information over to them at that point, that you had done what you needed to do, or what were you, did you have expectations of what
would there was a load off my back after I talked to them.
Okay.
And I thought, gee, something's going to get done here. And I let time. I'm not a pestering person. I have been here lately, but
yeah.
Anyway.
And I'm glad you.
I'm running out of time, ma'am.
Okay. So.
And I called both of them back. I called Dick Warner back, and I called Randy first, and he said, Bob, I really don't want to discuss it anymore, if you don't mind. And I said, well, okay, fine. And I called Dick Warner, and he said, Bob, lose my number. He said, please don't call me again.
Okay.
And I knew right then and there. I had already been called and talked to. They knew I had talked to them. And they, the ones I'm talking about, is a shadow government, City of Tulsa. If you think the mayor and the police chief run this city, no. You know better than that, don't you?
Well.
Yeah, you do.
I like my naive state.
Bathe in naivety.
Okay.
At any rate, this whole thing has been rather unsettling, but it's something I got to do.
Okay. And so
I have received over 100 threatening phone calls, and I know now for certain, beyond a shadow of a reasonable doubt, that my dealings with Dick back then inadvertently put me in the same group with a gentleman named Scott Ellsworth. And I didn't know that until here recently. And when my trouble started with threatening phone calls, and I got shot in the arm. And I stepped out of my front door, and when I got home from getting a bullet dug out of my arm, phone rang. You move, or we'd have killed you. So you better keep your damn mouth shut about that grave site, or you're going to die. I said, bring it on. Bring it on. You missed your chance. And I don't leave my property now unless I look it over real good. I don't step outside. Now, when I had my phone number changed, it all got quiet. And then I got a hold of Jana Clark. She did an article here recently, last year, in July, I think, or June. It was in June. She did an article on the website. And I called her. And I said, Jana, I know exactly where the gravesite is. I said, I I've shown other people that. If you'd like to see it, I know where it's at. Sure. So we went down there, and I got kind of mixed up, and I straightened it out with her later. I was going on landmarks, and they had bulldozed a whole block away so that the hillside I was familiar with was on Nogales and not Maybelle now. And when I realized the mistake that I'd made, I called her and told her. I said, we were at 7th and Nogales. We should have been at 8th and Maybelle. We were catty-cornered one block off. And she said, oh, okay, all right. Well, right after I had taken her up there, and we had checked the situation out, I got a threatening phone call. Okay.
As of last June.
And I'm trying to figure out who burnt me. Jana Clark. Yeah, all right. Then I just gave enough people enough rope and they hung themselves. I figured out from talking to Betsy Warner that Scott Ellsworth knew her dad and was talking to him back then.
That Dick Warner, Betsy's dad, knew Scott Ellsworth.
Right.
Yes, they worked very closely on that commissioned report. Yes.
Now, since then I have found out through Scott Ellsworth's secretary, or the person that handles his affairs with this commission, he has given my name and my physical address to anybody that talks to him. He's given my name and my number and my address to anybody that's curious about it. And I'm sure he did back then. And then I find out that he's in touch with Jana Clark. And I've been blaming the city of Tulsa for it. And it may not be the city of Tulsa. It may be some half-wit supremacist or Nazi or somebody like that, but I doubt it. But someone doesn't want me divulging this information, and it's irrelevant because I'm going to tell whoever I think I have to get these people a decent burial. But I found out that when my problems started, Scott Ellsworth is the only common denominator in all of it.
Well, and he certainly was, I'm assuming that he was hired for his work to do the investigative work as a part of the commission that was put together in 1997, and then that report was released in 2001.
Yeah.
Okay.
And please don't think that I'm being critical of Betsy Warner.
No. I mean, she's...
For doubting my word.
Yeah.
Because I know that she is a good investigator.
Yeah. Well, and she's going on what her father wrote. I'm thinking out loud. And if your conversation with Dick Warner was centered on the location and nothing else particularly, so...
Well, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm 90% certain that I hit on some of the aspects of these pictures.
Yeah.
Because that's just, it just comes out. I mean,
okay.
In the process of looking at horrible pictures, I saw pictures of a gravesite.
Okay. Do you think that there are other mass gravesite locations? Like, we keep looking at Oakland.
I have heard that there are.
Yeah, just like everybody else, we've heard that they're at Oakland or New Block Park or...
The story I got was the funeral homes that would take black people were completely overburdened. The official death count was 36. There were more people than that on one truck.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but anyway, there's been so many lies told about that riot that... It's just, it's a wonder it's still a part of history and hadn't been blown off as a, you know, as a rumor. But, and I'm sure there are people that wished it had.
Yeah.
But I don't.
So they, one of the sites that they keep looking at in terms of mass graves today is about New Block Park. So what I'm hearing you say, perhaps, is that the New Block Park was a temporary...
That's where all the bodies were collected.
And not permanently
right,
buried
interned.
There.
Right.
Okay.
Now, they have investigated the place in the Willows.
Right.
And that's south of this area. Mm-hmm. And I guess in order to do that, they're doing that because somebody had to have known that those bodies left going north. They couldn't have gone either way, west or east.
And they couldn't have gone...
You can't go south, that's
yeah.
the river.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, well, they carried him over there, they did something.
Okay.
And it's just right across the street.
So just so we can get this recorded, why they would not have gone west, let's talk about the landmarks or why that would not have been possible from the Willows... So Bob is currently drawing a map of the area.
All right, this is New Block Park. This is Charles Page Boulevard.
Okay.
This is 25th West Avenue.
Okay.
This is 8th Street. And this is Maybell.
Okay.
Now, this Maybell, this is 3rd Street. Here was the ice house. And they were driving from New Blount Park. It's more right down here.
Okay.
Haven't been there in a while. At any rate, they were just going right here and kept going by this curve. All right, this is the Frisco tracks right here. They go on around towards Sand Springs. This goes out, this crosses the tracks here and goes on out to Sand Springs. All right. The gentleman taking the picture was on a boxcar right here. I could tell by the grade and the angle.
Okay.
This ditch was dug right here. The dirt was pushed up in a pile here. One truck was backed up here.
Okay.
Two more were over here. Waiting. And from this angle, I could see that there were sheets and body parts or whatever was covered up in these two trucks. And they were pushing the bodies down the hill and into the ditch.
Okay.
And there were people standing here and here and one down into the grade with wheelbarrows. And the dozer was sitting up here with a blade,
okay,
like that, and they were throwing the body parts in here, and these guys were shoveling quicklime on top of them. And there were marshals everywhere. People standing with rifles. One of them up here had a BAR, full automatic, Browning automatic rifle. .30-06 caliber, World War I squad automatic weapon. So they were expecting the worst. And I am sure that nobody knew about this that wasn't involved in it. And the only people that I know of, there are three people driving his truck, and there's a bulldozer operator, and three convicts. So that's seven people that weren't U.S. Marshals knew about this.
Wait, let's get seven people who were not...
Three truck drivers.
Yeah, who were not U.S. Marshals.
Who were not law enforcement.
Who were witness to this event.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there were three convicts in striped pants, and there was a bulldozer operator.
Okay.
And I would assume, since he had a railroad hat on, that he was working for the railroad.
Okay. And how many marshals do you remember?
I would say there was 12, because there were 12 in the picture.
Okay.
There were six of them kneeling down, and six of them standing up. All
Post.
With U.S. federal marshals badges, not city police badges.
So that begs the question, no Tulsa City Police were on site or visible in any of
they
these
could have
photographs?
Been. They very well could have been. I couldn't see anything on this side.
Yeah, but in the photographs, they weren't there.
No, there were no Tulsa police officers in the photograph of the grave site.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
There was only marshals and, I'm going to say it's either a wide-brim fedora or a short brim cowboy hat, what they
right.
had on.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Hat of the times.
Yeah.
And they all had on the same colored jackets, and they were all their badges were the same. Most of them had lever action Winchesters. There were a couple of 12 gauge pump shotguns, and one of them had a full automatic weapon.
Your memory is astounding to me, but then that's why you're a police officer and I am not.
You learn to focus on detail.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a curse. It's when you go into that much for imprinting, it's hard to forget. When you see shit like that, it's just,
yeah,
you don't.
I understand.
I guess you judge people a little more harshly. You're a little more cynical. I was not totally incensed by these pictures, having been a combat veteran. Didn't bother me. And I think my only raw comment was, God, I hope he was dead, you know.
Yeah.
But These pictures, I'll kind of hint, can you imagine the mess that is left when a couple of vehicles pull a human being apart? That was the worst of it. That was the worst of it for me. And that's the one I said, God, I hope he was dead. But I know he wasn't. Had him chained under his arms and chains wrapped around his feet between two trucks. That was the worst of it. That and the fact in one of the pictures of somebody hacking someone down that had been hung, there were two police officers standing there watching, hack this person down with a machete.
Evil. What else do we need to know?
Hmm?
What else do we need to know? What else do you want to say to us?
I just hope that these people can finally wind up with a decent grave in a quiet, respectable place with a Christian burial. They deserve it. And why I think that way, I have no idea. I just do.
Because it's the right thing?
Because it's the right thing to do. What would it cost? $100,000? They spend that on lunch.
Well, I would hope that we're at the place where it's not about the money. I want to believe that. And I think that. It occurred to me that we probably did not... let's get your age on here. Did we do that? You gave your date of your birth.
I gave my date of birth.
Okay, good. And then I want you to talk about what you brought in today, about your plaque. Let's talk about that and why you received it and when. So let me get that.
Well.
And so that we're recorded. It's from Tulsa Lodge number 93 from the Fraternal Order of Police, presented to Robert Patty for meritorious service performed in the year of 1974. It's signed by Secretary Lyman Griffin and the President Joseph L.
Ezzanardi
Jr. Tell me about this plaque.
Well, I was given that plaque in 1974 after I took the life of a gentleman to save the life of two police officers. We received a call at Frankfort and Ute about a gentleman talking about a parking problem. And they assigned an officer that had a rookie. His name was Ira Reisinger, and the rookie was Bob Doss. Remember the Crossbow murder trial? That was Bob Doss. I just had a sneaky feeling. I'm gonna make that call. So I went up there with him. I'm glad I did. The call moved to a catty corner across the street. There was a bondsman named Elmer Lee Goff, and he had parked his vehicle across this gentleman's driveway. And this gentleman had called him to move his vehicle, and Elmer was drunk and gave him a cussing and told him that he'd kill him, meet me in the street, I'll kill your white ass. Elmer was black, this gentleman was white. I knew Elmer. And when the guy called his name, I said, I know him. I'll go with you to him. So we went to Elmer's front door. And I knocked on the door. And Elmer came out with a .45 automatic. And he made me real quick. He could see that Bob Doss was over here on my left. Bob had a flashlight in one hand, his ignite, and a notebook in the other hand. His training officer had a flashlight in one hand and a ham radio in his other hand. I had a flashlight in my hand, a heavily loaded .38 in my other hand. And when he came out the door, he pointed the gun at me. He looked at the other two and pointed the gun at me. And I said, drop the gun. I said, drop it. And he noticed that I had a bulletproof vest on. And he was looking at that bulletproof vest, and he stuck that gun up in my face. And I slapped that gun up with my flashlight and shot him 3 times in the chest. Then, after my trial was over for that, I was on the way home with another officer. We were going coyote hunting. And we stopped at Quick Trip to get a beer at 36th Street North in Peoria, or 46th Street North. 56th Street North in Peoria. Okay, been a while. We're going coyote hunting, we're going to get us a little beer. In the parking lot, there's a Mustang running with two blacks in it, backed up. Inside, there's a gentleman, and I stepped on the splash panel of my Chevrolet and looked up, and I said, Claude, get your 12 gauge. I said, get your 10 gauge. It's a robbery. And the guy come out the door with a sack of money and a pistol. And he saw Claude standing there with his double-barrel shotgun, and he aimed at Claude, and I popped him through the neck. And the same instant, Claude gave him both barrels of a double-barrel 10-gauge and blew him back through the window. So that was two murders in about 6-7 days, and I guess they felt it in their heart that I needed one of them, because that was three peace officers' lives I'd saved in about a week. It's probably one of my most prized possessions. And it's not from the city of Tulsa. It's from my fellow officers.
I see that.
And at the time I received it, there were seven of them in existence. From the time they started giving those awards until the time I received that, seven of them had been given out since, I think, 27 or 1928. But it's an object of pride, but then again, it's not for the reason that I got it. You understand that?
I do.
It really made me feel good. It really did. They got together out the lodge and handed that to me. Shit, I think I cried. But
you're crying now.
Probably.
Yeah.
I have PTSD really bad. And for years, I was a cold, stone cold killer. I made my living as a peace officer in six cities in two states until I just couldn't anymore. And I love helping people, and that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Now, I'm no hero. I am no hero.
Well, we're playing.
I'm an ordinary man that's been just stuck himself in some very unordinary circumstances and survived, I guess.
Yeah.
But
okay.
That's exactly where that grave is. And
okay.
I'm gonna put a from the center line of the road. From the this is the road. Normally this is 22 feet right here.
Mm-hmm.
On where this road intersects right here to right here, that's right at the edge of the road.
Got it.
And down here the grade goes down maybe 15 to 20 feet. So this is a slope right here. And they had to dig it out this way just a little bit to keep this bank from falling down when they dug it so deep right here. So we're probably...
So this is on the southwest corner of that curve.
Yeah, This is eight. No, wait a minute. This is eight right here.
Right, and that's Maybell. Okay, so it's southwest of 8th and
Maybell. It's just a little bit more west than it is south.
Okay, got it.
And this is probably to the center of this. This is 12 feet, I'm going to say, just from judging by the distance of the ditch on each side of the 8-foot dozer blade. I could tell you can't dig an 8-foot wide ditch with an 8-foot blade. You have to make it wider.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
So this is going to be 12 to 15 feet wide here. And it's probably going to be around 12 to 15 feet here. Between the edge of the road right here and this deal right here.
Okay.
So, if you'd like to go up there, we can, where you come in off of 3rd Street, you can still see the curb line where Maybell went south. But it's all, a block has been taken out and torn away. And now, I'm pretty sure there may be railroad tracks over this gravesite.
Okay.
Because they have added, they have, for a while there wasn't any railroad tracks there at all. Mm-hmm. And then they put one set of tracks in, and then they widened the area, and now there's two sets of tracks that go through there. Oh, and I forgot my lensatic compass. I have a lensatic compass. We could get here on 8th Street, and I can pick a site in the distance and strike a line with a lensatic compass and then get off Maybell from up here on 3rd and sight south with it and find the focal point. And that way, I can find this intersection right here.
Okay. Well, Jerry Parkhurst may have one for all we know. Okay. So we're going to leave here, and we're going to go look at the site. But before we do, I feel like you and I have built an element of trust with one another. I'm wondering, are you willing to speak with Randy Crable again on
Certainly.
The Tulsa World? Okay. Are you willing to speak with, particularly I'm thinking of a man named Hannibal Johnson, who has written a number of books and is a local historian on the race massacre?
If anyone has any chance of helping me,
okay,
I'll tell my story to anybody.
Okay. And here's what I will do. I have connections into those who are looking for the mass graves. I'd like for us to go out and look. Let's get all of our facts and all. And then the Mass Grave Commission, I can have conversations. I can have conversation with Mayor G.T. Bynum and say, this is what we're looking at. Let me get educated.
I called his office and offered to talk to him.
And the response was not much.
Hadn't got back with me yet.
Okay. I think I can help facilitate that.
Well, he said something on TV about if there's anybody, he would like to talk to someone.
Yeah.
About, if anybody knows anything about a mass grave. let's see.
Okay. We'll do our best to tell the story, and I am grateful that you have been brave enough.
I am grateful to you for your interest in this.
Okay.
And I'm not helping you. You're helping me.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
That's how I'm looking at this. And you don't owe me any thanks at all.
Okay. Well, we are in history. Well, thank you. So I'm going to end this recording, and we are going to go out to the site and look. All right. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.